How do you get kids excited about science? MJ Mouton did by writing a rhyming children's book about the physicist Richard Feynman.
I would read science books to my kids because I wanted them to have an understanding of science. And what I learned was most science books are just facts. I wanted to make a book that a kid's going to go pick up off the shelf again. So they're bedtime stories, and we sneak the science.
Plus, the Miller Park Zoo in Bloomington is one of the oldest in the country.
So that's Rojo, our tiger. He just got fed.
We hear about its nationally known snow leopard conservation program, but first, you might have read news headlines about the decline of manufacturing in the Midwest. We'll hear how some cities like Grand Rapids have managed to not just survive, but thrive when creating manufacturing jobs. That's all coming up on this Encore edition of the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to this Encore edition of the 21st. I'm Nyla Boudou. We often hear about how manufacturing has declined in the U.S., especially over the past few decades. And conventional wisdom holds it's because of cheaper labor in foreign countries and the rise of robotics, and the Great Recession didn't help, especially here in the Midwest. But new research shows that some local labor markets have managed to not just survive, but thrive over the past decade. Take Grand Rapids, Michigan. Its post-recession manufacturing job growth has outpaced the national average. Tim Bartik is a senior economist for the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo, Michigan. He's the author behind that research I just mentioned. Jared Bernstein is an economist in Washington. He was the chief economist to former Vice President Joe Biden and is currently a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. I spoke with both of them back in May. So there's lots of policy implications here, but I wondered if we can start with the overall narrative. And Jared, we often hear about the quote-unquote decline of American manufacturing, or that robots are taking all of our jobs. What's behind that, and how accurate do you think that is?
I don't think it's as accurate as a lot of people think it is. There's an impression that our manufacturing sector is kind of disappeared in terms of jobs due to pressure from globalization and from technology, as you suggest. But that's not the case. And in fact, there's some really interesting regional variation that I know Tim will talk about. In both cases, I would say there's been too much of a view that it is inevitable that the United States can't support a more robust manufacturing sector. And I'm here to tell you that that's not inevitable at all. And in fact, it's partly the result of policy that hasn't paid enough attention to the sector and of policies that we've not enacted that could help it more.
Tim, what made you picked a couple of cities that you focused on. What made you want to look at these cities and how well they've done?
Well, I wanted to see if, in fact, it was possible for manufacturing areas to be successful. And what I found is that when you look at all the local labor markets in the U.S. that are the most intensive in manufacturing, that's the greatest share of their jobs in manufacturing. In fact, you know, roughly one-fifth of them have been reasonably successful over the past 10 years or so, when manufacturing has somewhat stabilized. So in Grand Rapids is one example, Lehigh Valley is another example, and there are others. And some of them have in fact been successful by actually having manufacturing jobs expand. So it is possible for areas to succeed in manufacturing as long as the sector overall is not declining drastically nationally the way it did in the early 2000s. But of course, a lot of that decline nationally in the early 2000s was due to the exchange rate, U.S. exchange rates getting totally out of whack. And that's not inevitable going forward with the right national policies. But as long as we can keep manufacturing jobs roughly stable nationally, which I think is quite possible, areas can succeed if they invest in the right mix of services to manufacturers and the right mix of job skill investments.
So you looked at some larger metropolitan areas or places that had more than a million people. You mentioned Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania, Grand Rapids in Michigan, Charlotte, North Carolina, Silicon Valley. I think Silicon Valley is kind of an obvious economic story. But what's going on with these other cities? Do they share some commonalities?
Well, the things you find in common among the cities succeeded is, one, they tend to have higher skills than other cities. They tend to have a higher percentage of their population that has a college degree or more. So they are able to compete, therefore, in the more advanced manufacturing jobs, or for that matter, in the more advanced jobs in other industries. The other thing they have is they've shown some sizable investments in what I call customized business services. So these are things like manufacturing extension services or customized job training. And what these are services that work with small and medium-sized businesses and try to help them be more competitive. So manufacturing extension is a program that every state has, including Illinois, and the federal government puts some money into it, and then the states put some money into it, and then there's some fees. And they provide essentially low-cost, high-quality consulting advice to smaller manufacturers to help them figure out how to be more competitive in the world economy. And these services have shown very high effectiveness in helping these manufacturers, and it's a way of growing manufacturing jobs in a positive way.
And to that point about jobs, I think we often hear about a skills gap when it comes to manufacturing. Jared, can you first define what that skills gap is that often that we I think people always, this term gets thrown around a lot. Oh, there's a skills gap in manufacturing.
Mm-hmm. Well, the term gets thrown around quite broadly, as I'm sure you know, not just for manufacturing. And what it's saying is that there's a gap, allegedly, between the employer's demands for the skills that workers bring when they show up for a job and the skills that those workers have. So for as long as I can remember, employers have basically said, I can't find the workers I want. And oftentimes that is framed as a skills gap. And we certainly hear about that in manufacturing as well. One of the reasons why economists tend to be pretty skeptical of that is if there were truly such a deep skills gap, we'd see more upward pressure on wage offers. And we really haven't seen that either in manufacturing or in any other sector, really, for that matter. Seeing a little bit more of it now that the unemployment rate is so low, at least nationally, as well as in Illinois, relative to where it's been. But the notion of a skills gap gets thrown around without a lot of precision. I would definitely underscore Tim's point that if you're thinking of manufacturing as a bunch of guys, because that's traditionally what it was, kind of standing around a production line just, you know, putting screws into holes, that ain't right anymore. And so, yes, certainly more advanced skills, much more computerization, and by the way, more robotics shows up in our manufacturing sector. But I think it's quite easy to forget that, you know, somebody has to actually build or manufacture those robots. And there's a lot more manufacturing production that goes on than we think, and that could actually be expanded, I think, with smart national policy.
Tim, I wonder if you could, your research does look at Grand Rapids in particular, and I wonder when we're thinking about practical things that they did in Grand Rapids in Michigan, you mentioned manufacturing extension in terms of working with small to medium-sized manufacturers when we were talking about the skills gap as well. What specifically did Grand Rapids do post-recession?
Well, there's a host of things they've been doing. It's not just post-recession. It's really something they've been doing over a number of years. I do think, you know, we need to realize economic development is a long-term game. It's not like you just do things 1 year and it all pays off in 3 years. You have to make some long-term investments in various services. So the Grand Rapids area for a long time has been trying to make its manufacturing sector more competitive. They bring together clusters of manufacturers' business and discuss common problems. They discuss things like whether or not certain skills are needed. They also discuss how to help businesses diversify. So they, for example, have helped some of their auto parts manufacturers diversify into making parts for various medical, for healthcare industry. So they're trying to diversify into a growing industry. I mean, but if you're taking plastic and making it into parts for autos, you can also take plastic and make it into parts for the healthcare industry. And so they've been working with those individual businesses in clusters trying to help them do that. They have put significant resources into education. They made a successful effort to convince Michigan State to relocate its medical school in Grand Rapids. They've invested heavily in downtown development, which has helped make the area more attractive as a place for people to live. So it's a wide variety of investments that they've been doing, not just since the recession, but really going back 30 years.
And Jared, how much of do you think this requires investment rather than, I think we oftentimes hear of things like business incentives versus, and that's what will bring businesses to a town versus the kind of level investment that Tim is talking about that Grand Rapids devoted?
Yeah, it's a really important question because I would say that most policymakers, we're certainly seeing this now with a bunch of mayors trying to get the Amazon HQ2 to come to their city, really overemphasize the tax incentives versus the kinds of investments that Tim is talking about. In fact, at the end of the day, you might get somebody to show up if you kind of bribe them with enough tax breaks, but it turns out that for the living standards and the longer-term quality of economic life in the places we're discussing, the type of investments that have to do with skills and education, with transportation hubs, with cleaning up brownfields, with infrastructure that's commensurate with high productivity production, so educational interventions of the type that Tim was mentioning, these have a much more lasting impact and ultimately provide a bigger bang for the buck in terms of local jobs. So I think that insight has been kind of missed in the very short-termism pursuit of winning a big kind of contract with one of the big high-name companies that's asking for a tax handout.
And Tim, what did you – go ahead, Tim.
About tax incentives is two things. One is that not all these incentives actually trigger the location decision. In fact, when people try to do serious studies of this, it's pretty hard to find incentives that induce more than 15 or 20% of the incentive jobs. In other words, 85% of the time, the company would have come here anyway, or some similar company would have come here. So 85% of the time, you're just giving out the incentive, not getting anything. 15% of the time, it might trigger the investment. The other thing people forget is you have to pay for these incentives. This is not a free lunch. So how are you paying for these? If you're doing a property tax abatement, for example, where you reduce property taxes, maybe you're implicitly financing it by lowering spending on public schools. And yet we know that investing in public school quality is one of the most effective ways of building up the skills of your local workforce. We have to, once you take account of those two factors, tax incentives is a pretty costly way of trying to create job growth in a local community.
And to that point, when we're thinking about this, Jared, I can't help but think about what's going on here in Illinois. The state's still pretty much in a fiscal crisis. The state's, you know, been taking tax revenue from local municipalities to make up the difference in state revenue. When you're in a situation that Illinois is in, which is a little bit different, I think, than other surrounding Midwestern states, when you don't have the resources to make these kind of investments, how hard is it for a state who can't afford to make investments in infrastructure and these things to try to keep these jobs here?
Well, of course, it's that much harder. I mean, pretty much everything that Tim and I have talked about has involved some level of investment. I think that a lot of times we kind of walk around thinking that there's no way to raise more revenues through our tax systems. And I understand that that's a very tough thing to do for a politician. It's easy for me to say I'm not running for office. But there certainly have been proposals in Illinois to try to claw back some more tax revenue, especially from those at the top of the income scale, and invest it, not just give it to somebody else, middle class or poor people, that actually invest it in long-term productive employment. I also think that in cases like Illinois, but other states, you could say very much say the same thing, there's very much a federal role for that sort of investment. So one of the things Tim mentioned in passing is something that I'll bet almost nobody knows about. It's called the Manufacturing Extension Partnership. And it's a function within our Commerce Department, so it's part of the federal government, and it provides some of the customized services that Tim was discussing earlier. I mean, you take a small manufacturer who might be having trouble getting a loan or figuring out a way to, as Tim mentioned, access markets it's not accessing, or even link up to the global supply chain. Oftentimes, a small manufacturer doesn't have the resources to come up with that. Well, the MEP, the Manufacturing Extension Partnership, is this policy group within the Commerce Department that provides this service in every state. And they do it at a very small budget. It's a few 200 million, and I live in Washington, we talk in trillions. So this is something that, you know, the Trump administration wants to get rid of, which I think is a terrible idea. I would double or triple their resources so that they could play more of a role in places like Illinois that are dealing with budget crunches.
Tim, I'll let you have the last word. We're almost out of time, but just very briefly, what do you think the biggest takeaway should be for municipalities, local political leaders looking at this?
It's possible to succeed in manufacturing. Succeeding in manufacturing shouldn't rely on tax incentives, quick fixes that are politically attractive but are pretty costly per job created. You should rely more on trying to build up the basics of your economy, and that includes helping your small manufacturers through these various customized services like the Manufacturing Extension Partnership, and also investing in the skills of your local workforce. And to do that requires local leadership that can mobilize those local resources, and it also requires a supportive environment where state government, the federal government, help local areas that may not have the resources themselves to provide these kind of services.
That's Tim Bartik, a senior economist with the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. I want to thank him, along with economist Jared Bernstein. Gentlemen, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Richard Feynman was one of the world's greatest physicists. He was born in 1918 in New York and won the Nobel Prize in 1965. He is known in the scientific community for figuring out how to visually map out the math that determines how subatomic particles behave. But it's more than that. Feynman is remembered for his passion, for his ability to describe complex physics to everyday people, and just for having a lot of fun exploring science throughout his entire life. So perhaps it's fitting that Aurora, Illinois-based children's book author M.J. Mouton wrote a new book about what Richard Feynman was like as a kid. It's called Richie Doodles, The Brilliance of a Young Richard Feynman. M.J., welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Pretty awesome to be here.
Why Richard Feynman out of all of the scientists? I should mention, it's not the first book you've done in this Tiny Thinker series, but it's the most recent one.
No, it's the one that our publishers wanted to put next. But I have 40 what I consider good stories that I wrote for my daughters probably about 7 years ago. There's actually about 60 stories in total, but 20 of them need a lot of work. And so the reason I wrote the Richard Feynman story was not necessarily because he's a physicist, but he's pretty much an awesome example of somebody who thinks outside the box, somebody who looks at things differently, and somebody who was a great communicator of science. And what he did was he was able to simplify something that was extremely complex and be able to share that with the layman person. So I like the fact of the Richard Feynman book coming out second, because I think I tried to take it to another level, to take it down to a child. So often, scientists don't have the abilities to communicate with the general public, and it takes science communicators to convey complex things. And so that's what the Tiny Thinkers books do. They portray complex ideas, but to a kid who's between 4 and 6 years old, even though the books are geared for kids 1 through 8, you know, if parents read it, Richard Feynman did so much, and I'm proud that it's the second book because it conveys that message. Look at things from a different point of view, from a different perspective, and you can teach complex things to kids. They can do it.
How did you learn about, what research did you do into his life?
Richard Feynman has a ton of lectures that are out there that you can listen to and learn about the science of it, but there's a ton of documentaries as well. The BBC did a fantastic documentary on Richard Feynman, and then he wrote his own book, Surely You're Joking, and several other books. So for the most part, it comes from reading books about Richard Feynman and seeing the documentaries. Before I wrote any of the books, I used documentaries on my drive to and from work, and I learned, for the most part, word for word, every ounce of that documentary. I read what I can, and then when it's time to sit down and write a story, it comes naturally and it becomes easy. I don't typically write about a person's life. I write about an inspiring moment in that scientist's young life that made them go on to be the person that they are.
And what do you think that moment was for Richard Feynman?
His relationship with his dad. His relationship with his dad was, if he asked a question, his dad would, for the most part, make him look for an answer himself, in a sense. So Richard Feynman can ask a question like, hey, Dad, I'm pulling this wagon, and when I stop, the ball keeps moving. And his dad explains inertia. So he had this father who was able to explain stuff. Now, he was a gifted mind. He won, I think, the New York math competition. And so he was already a brilliant mind. But his father nurtured his brilliance by challenging him in a lot of different ways. And that way, a lot of those ways was explaining to him, you can know the name of something, but if you don't know how it works, you know nothing about it. And he even talks about that in those documentaries, of how those influences were, the way his dad spoke with him and the way his dad interacted with him was a huge part in how he looked at things.
I'm speaking with Aurora-based children's book author M.J. Mouton. His most recent book is called Richie Doodles, and it's about the physicist Richard Feynman. And you mentioned that for Richard Feynman, it was his dad who nurtured him and inspired him. You started writing all of these stories for your daughters. Are you hoping that more children will become interested in science just reading these stories about these great minds?
Absolutely. So I wrote these stories for my daughters for a certain reason, but I wanted to get them published for a different reason. There's people who never know academic heroes, and often they don't know those academic heroes until they get a little bit older. So we're in the Chicago area. If you go into, say, South Chicago, into economically depressed area, urban area, and you ask any kid out there, who is Jackie Robinson? Every kid will be able to tell you who Jackie Robinson was because he was a barrier breaker in sports. But if you would ask him, say, who is Percy Julian? Percy Julian was possibly the greatest chemist that America has ever produced. He was born in Birmingham, Alabama, but his labs and his life mostly happened up here in Oak Park in the Chicago area. Percy Julian synthesized the natural drugs that are in plants. And so he first started off with stigmasterol and these drugs that could help women after giving birth. But later on, it was things like cortisone and stuff. This guy is America's greatest chemist, and no one knows his name. So when he was a child, well, he got his start by seeing a guy named St. Elmo Brady, and St. Elmo Brady was the first chemist ever in America. And Percy Julian said, if Elmo Brady can do it, so can I. And so hopefully by putting a lot of these scientists out there, that some other kid can look at it and say, hey, if Percy Julian did it, so can I. If Marie Curie did it, so can I. If Carl Sagan did it, so can I. And they need to be introduced at a young age. I didn't realize until I was much older in life my love for science. Because where I grew up, I didn't have any inspiration in that world. And then
that was in southern Louisiana?
That was in southern Louisiana. And it's a shame that that doesn't happen in southern Louisiana because we have one of the most diverse ecosystems in the entire country, yet we have people who should be biologists, who should, you know, be in those scientific fields, and we're importing them when we should be producing them. And a lot of it is you're not taught to look beyond your rural community at what your potential is. So if you don't get to move away, if you don't get to see your potential, you'll just stay rurally anchored to your area. And some of our most brilliant people who could be a mechanical engineer is a mechanic. The girls who go on to be nurses or school teachers, they have so much more potential, but their rural surroundings never offered anything other than what they could see as a viable option to stay where they're at and to live a decent life. But their potential is so much more. So they need to be introduced to people. And it doesn't even have to be a scientist. You'll see in life, if you have an aunt or an uncle who is the first to finish college, you'll see the nieces and nephews finish college as well. And so you need to have a hero. And a lot of places there aren't heroes, and I hope those books can provide one or two.
My guest is children's book author MJ Mouton about his recent book in the Tiny Thinker series. They're books for children, and he's saying ages 1 to 8. His first book was about Charles Darwin. It was called Charlie and the Tortoise. This newest book is called Richie Doodles, about the life of physicist Richard Feynman. So who was the hero for you when you were a kid?
It was human beings for me because I moved away and I started working, and I went into the environmental construction field. So now I'm a worker-type operator, labor-type worker, and then I'm getting to work around biologists, and I'm getting to work around anthropologists and stuff to that nature. So when I would see something that fascinated me, I had somebody to ask that question to that could give me a real answer. And I would guess, I would say that I had a weird introduction into finding stuff. My dad would... We grew up in South Louisiana hunting and fishing. We were looking for bullet casings because we reloaded our own ammunition to hunt and stuff to that nature. So you were always looking at the ground and finding Indian artifacts and stuff to that nature. Later on, when I got into the atmosphere where I worked, and I'm seeing not only those things, but different layers of soils and stuff to that, I had real scientists to ask questions to. And then I realized, man, I have this in my blood. Because once somebody loves something or is inspired to love something, they're going to go seek the information on their own. So in the sense of like, I'll use my dad as an example because we were always looking for bullets. And somebody may say, well, he never went to college. He wasn't educated. But you ask him about something that he loves, say, in that situation, his love was guns and stuff to that nature. He can tell you the make and model of every gun, the rifling of the barrel. He could tell you the spin. He could tell you all these technical and scientific aspects of what that does. And you find the same thing in mechanics. They may know thermodynamics, they just don't know the word. And so this guy is scientifically minded, he just wasn't ever inspired to take that knowledge any further. But once they love something, cars or that or something else, you seek knowledge on your own. And so if you inspire somebody to love something at a young age, they'll seek that.
What I really enjoyed about this story was about Richard Feynman was talking about how he loved to draw and he had these doodles. And I love the story that you have in here that encourages children to just sketch and do that on their own because it played such an important role with Richard Feynman ultimately being able to understand how subatomic particles actually move and behave.
Many of the stories are like that. In the Richard Feynman book, what I'm trying to convey is that Richard Feynman always looked for an easier way to explain something. But more in the sense of what you were just talking about, we have a guy named George Cuvier back in the 1700s whose mother taught him how to draw, and she was an artist. And they would draw the animals around the house. you know, that they could find in their yard. And he drew them with such great detail that by the time he was 17 years old, he was a professor in college because he knew more about animals than any other person. And then he eventually grew up. His claim to fame is what he did was he improved the taxonomy of animals by, you know, kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. That's where he worked, because once he got into a college setting, he knew more about animals from the outside, but once he got in that college setting, he was able to learn about the animals from the inside. And his inspiration came from his mother actually teaching him to draw. And then another she's not a professional scientist, but there was one named Mary Ward, and she's the one who I most identify with. And she liked to draw the smallest of details of things, little plants, wings of insects, not the whole insects, but the smallest things. And an astronomer seen her drawing one day and told her father, you should give her a microscope so she can see things smaller. And he did that. And so she would draw things in the smallest of details. She wasn't, let's say, college educated or anything like that. Eventually, she had this book of drawings that she had done, and it's just Mary Ward's raw nature. She did that on her own. She was self-taught. She did it. She wrote. She didn't think that anybody would publish a book by an uneducated female back in that time. So she self-produced the book herself, producing 250 copies. They sold out in weeks. It went to 8 prints, and it was called The World Through a Microscope. And this is somebody who I would identify with, but she was encouraged when she was a young kid by just somebody saw potential, and she had a love for something, and she made it happen.
That said, what do you, as we think about this book, it sounds like you are hoping to inspire a whole other generation of children with this story in particular, but all the stories you're writing about.
All the stories I'm writing about. You want to inspire, but oftentimes kids aren't even exposed. And so they need some form of exposure. And I would read science books to my kids because I wanted them to have an understanding of science. And what I learned was most science books are just facts. You know, Marie Curie was born November 7th, 1867 in Poland. And you can read that book to your kid. You may get through it. They're probably going to nod off. And at nighttime, when you want to read a bedtime story, they go to the shelves. They're never going to pull that book and bring it back to you because that book is boring to them. But what they are going to bring back is Dr. Seuss. And Dr. Seuss, 10 times out of 10, they're going to come back. If you tell them to go get 3 books, they're going to, and Dr. Seuss is in the mix, they're going to come back with that Dr. Seuss book. Because it's a bedtime story, it's in rhyme form, it's entertaining, and it's colorful. So what we did, and what I did for the Tiny Thinkers books, is I made something that was in rhyme form that my kids would want to hear multiple times, and they enjoyed them. This is before they're even books. These are just stories that I have, for the most part, have memorized, and I got my daughter laying there, and I'm just saying it in rhyme form, and sometimes she adds something to it or doesn't. I wanted to make a book that a kid's going to go pick up off the shelf again. So they're bedtime stories, and we sneak the science.
That book is just out. It's called Richie Doodles, The Brilliance of a Young Richard Feynman. The author is Aurora, Illinois-based MJ Mouton. MJ, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It was awesome. We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to this encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. For well over a century, people in the Bloomington Normal area have been visiting the Miller Park Zoo. In fact, for a long time, it was the only zoo between St. Louis and Chicago. Miller Park Zoo opened in the late 1800s. Now located on historic Route 66, it continues to be popular with travelers. We spent some time there during our visit to Bloomington back in April on a pretty cold day. Director Jay Tetzloff showed us around. So, Jay, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about the history of this. Miller Park opened to, was it right that this was to house exotic animals after a traveling circus left behind the lion cub?
Yeah. So the zoo started in 1891. That's the records. That's as far back as records go. The animal building that we'll see in a little bit, it was built in 1914. It was built for a lion cub that a farmer found. Big Jim was his name. Was the lion cub's name.
The farmer?
I don't know what the farmer's name. The lion cub's name was Big Jim.
And now, today, what does the collection look like?
So in terms of animal collection, we have about 600 animals, over 175 different species. I don't count our hissing cockroaches or our walking sticks. I don't count our invertebrate collection as part of that.
And you also have a large collection of endangered animals. Can you tell us about Miller Park Zoo's work in that area?
Sure. Some of our more popular animals are endangered. Our red wolves are critically endangered. Snow leopards are endangered. Sumatra tiger are critically endangered. So these are animals that could disappear very easily in our lifetime. Red wolf has been extinct in the wild once, and we're on the path to be extinct in the wild again. That's an animal from North Carolina. That's not from North Africa. That's not from Southeast Asia. That's from the U.S. So if we can't save a high-profile, mega mammal, apex predator from the U.S., I worry about frogs in Panama.
And what kind of work do you all do with helping? I guess it sounds like, are there breeding programs or what kind of things are you doing?
Yeah, breeding programs are the biggest things that we're doing right now. For example, the snow leopard breeding program, we manage that program on behalf of basically North America. So working with 70 other zoos across North America, we have about 160 snow leopards in North America right now. Moving cats around, breeding with who we feel is in the best interest of the population. The goal for us is to have a sustainable program and population so that my great-grandkids can come to a zoo in North America and see a snow leopard. We've had 5 cubs born over the last 3 years. We suspect our female's pregnant now. So we're looking at cubs in June, hopefully. One is still here. She actually leaves this week. She'll go to a zoo in South Dakota. We've had one go to Kansas, New York. So you figure out the best situation from a genetic standpoint. So for snow leopards, one of our females that's still here, she's going to go to a zoo that doesn't want to breed snow leopards. And she does have a little bit of an eye defect. So we've chosen not to breed her. And so she's going to a zoo that's not going to breed her. They're going to use her as an exhibit animal and tell people that live in that area of what snow leopards are like, which is still a great purpose.
And so do you do genetic testing on the animals before you match them up? How does one go about matching these animals?
Sure. For us, it's mostly about population genetics. So it's not necessarily what genes you have. It's who you're related to in the population. So if you're brought in, so palace cat's a small exotic cat from Mongolia. Not many are in the States. We're actually importing a male for our female. He's in the Czech Republic. He's unrelated to pretty much everything else in the population in the U.S. So he's a very valuable animal once he gets here. He's pretty common over in Europe, but once he gets here, his genetics will be unrepresented until he reproduces. So we do as much of that as we can. It's basically based on population genetics. Pretty boring stuff for most people.
Well, I imagine for other zoos, though, this is the kind of thing where you are interacting with other zoos. Is it not just around the country, but around the world, it sounds like?
It's around the world in some programs. Red panda, Sumatran tiger, palace cat. We're working with everybody, our neighbors across both sides of the ocean. Toronto got a zoo for a snow leopard from Japan. So, yeah, we're moving cats and animals all over the world because we're doing what's best for that population.
You mentioned the history of the zoo. I'm wondering if, in comparison, I'm thinking about Lincoln Park Zoo opened in the 1860s, and I know mm-hmm. that's considered one of the oldest mm-hmm. zoos in the country. Where is Miller Park Zoo in that list of oldest?
So we opened in 1891. We are the 13th oldest. Philadelphia Zoo is number one. I think they're like 1740. No, I'm sorry, like 1740, something like that. So 1891 is pretty old.
Where do your visitors come from? All over the state?
We've started tracking our guests. We're having about 2/3 of our guests come outside of McLean County that are our paid guests. We have a lot of members, and we figure the members are local, so we just ask our paying guests where they're from. The biggest group that we get comes from the Champaign-Urbana area, but we see them from Chicago. We see them. We have regulars that come from Wisconsin. And we're seeing kind of a regional draw for us, which is a great thing.
Should we go outside and maybe you can show us some highlights of the zoo?
So this is an unseasonably cold day.
Yes.
What do you give the animals a choice as to whether or not they are inside or out?
So we are set up for winter probably by the end of September. So because with Illinois winters, it could be, we could get a blizzard in October, it's very possible. So it depends on the animal. If it can tolerate our winter, then everything's fine. If they can't, then we give them access to a building. We bring them inside for the winter. We move them to the other part of the zoo. Lots of different, it all depends on what kind of animal it is. So our Eurasian eagle owls, so a large owl species, it's one of the largest.
Yeah.
They are cold hardy. They have access to their little box.
Yeah, he doesn't say he's not even outside.
So that's the female in the box there.
Okay.
And then the male's right to above her to the left.
Oh, right. Wow.
So Eurasian eagle owl.
Great camouflage.
And they like the cold. And then our river otters. I'll show you a video monitor. So we had pups born. So this is this is a one-year-old daughter. She's going to a zoo in Massachusetts.
Okay, the one who's right over there.
It's one that's in here now. Mom and the two babies are in the back.
Okay.
Not quite ready to come out. So this is the indoor rainforest and the Katofa Animal Building, the building from 1914.
So this is one of the original buildings?
Yes. We keep it about 70 degrees in the wintertime.
Tropical for the, particularly for the primates?
Everything that's in here. Is from a Central or South American rainforest. So saki monkeys, cotton-top tamarins, and then all the 20 to 25 to 30 birds that are free flight in this building.
Okay.
So it's a place for our guests to come and kind of feel as though they're walking through the rainforest. All that plants on the waterfall, that's from my dad's funeral.
Oh, wow.
And we'll take cuttings and bring more cuttings in. So I have a personal relationship to this place.
What's your goal with the kids who come here?
The goal is, one, to get them outside. I mean, get them off phones and screens. We want them to understand and learn and get engaged about wildlife. The next generation is the one that's going to depend on if what I did during my time was worth it. Because we want to be a good steward. We want to pass on that stewardship to our grandkids, to our great-grandkids. If people grow up and don't care about wildlife, don't care about natural spaces, green spaces, they're going to disappear. And if they disappear, then all of our animals are going to disappear. And then that's going to affect us. You know, pollinators are in huge decline right now. That's how we eat. So without pollinators, we're going to struggle as a species, if you want to say that, to find food and to be able to do what we want to do as people who live in Illinois. So this is the Katofa Animal Building. Opened in 1914 and was renovated in the 70s. And it's kind of due for another renovation. It's still the old style of zoo building, zoo exhibits. So in fact, this winter we're going to be doing some things like taking out all the old mesh, the old caging, and putting up much softer look so that you can see the animal better, the animal can see out a little bit better. We're going to increase the lighting, we're going to increase the skylights in here, and make it a little bit friendlier, more modern building.
And for you all, is it challenging financially to run a zoo like this?
It is for us, as we're part of the city of Bloomington. As a city of Bloomington, we're struggling financially as sales tax has dropped with our retail, much like it is across a lot of different locations. So that does affect us. This year we had a $3 million deficit through a few fee increases and some cuts, which luckily didn't affect the zoo very much. We're all kind of feeling that heat a little bit and trying to make sure we're as efficient and as effective as we can with the dollars we do receive. We try to increase our fundraising as much as we can. So the improvements I just talked about with the new mesh and skylights, that's all private money. It's all fundraised money. There's no tax dollars coming from that. So we hear a lot of people that talk about how great they love that fact that we have a public-private partnership and able to raise some of our own funds. Some buildings like this building, if we were to renovate this entire building, we're talking $6-7 million. That's going to be a tough dollar amount to make in any environment, any economy. A pair of gray gibbons here, the snow leopards, and then tiger. Okay. Yeah, so this is our young lady who's leaving for a zoo in South Dakota this week. And you just heard the tiger.
So with the snow leopards, you said you've had 5 cubs born in the past year through the
In the
breeding?
Past 3 years.
The past 3 years.
Yep, a litter of 2 that we had to hand raise, and then a litter of 3. And we think that she's pregnant now.
How did this zoo, how did Miller Park Zoo become specializing, how did the zoo specialize in snow leopards in particular in the breeding program and working with this critical species?
For snow leopards, it was a program that I brought with me when I came from another zoo. So I've run the program for about 10 years now. I've been here almost 9. So I brought the snow leopard program here, and we really focused on breeding snow leopards since I got here. You know, when it comes to the breeding programs, you know, we all have to work together. It's all cooperative. Zoos have to leave their ego at the door and really focus and work on together. Otherwise, these programs won't work. So that's Rojo, our tiger. Rojo is a Sumatra tiger. It's the smallest subspecies of tiger in the world. They're the darker markings. Just beautiful cats. He just got fed.
So, sorry, is he normally this active?
This is a little bit more than what he normally is. Anytime we do something different, sometimes they catch on to that. Sometimes that bothers them. But he's no worse for wear. You know, activity is not a bad thing for these guys. Tigers sleep 15 to 20 hours a day. Making sure that just... beautiful cat.
I was gonna
love
say,
those markings.
Beautiful.
Love
and
those markings.
How much does he weigh?
He's a little under 300 pounds. So again, the smallest subspecies of tiger that's out there. You get Amur tigers or Siberian tigers, they can hit 600, 650 pounds. So these guys get a commercially processed beef. And then we give them cattle knuckle bones twice a week. That's for their teeth and jaws. Since they're not eating a carcass like a deer in the wild, we want to make sure that their teeth and jaws stay strong. A lot of tigers, big cats in general, in the wild, they live to about 10 to 12, and they start seeing teeth problems, and they pass away in the wild. In zoos, we can give things like a root canal and take out that tooth, and they can live another 5 to 10 years. We fast them for at least 12 hours when we're doing some type of immobilization.
And then you put them on a commercial flight?
In this case, they're being picked up by a truck and trailer. But a lot of times we do put them on planes. When we get animals in, a lot of times they're on a plane. It's pretty common. If you're flying a large Delta flight, a large United flight, there's a good chance there's going to be some type of animal in one of the cargo holds.
And if it was something like a snow leopard, would someone be traveling with the animal then?
Usually, but not necessarily. We try to drive the big cats or the big animals from a cost perspective, from a safety perspective, for them, their welfare. But a lot of times we will put something on a plane, and we'll go there just like, I think Thursday we're getting some birds in. We'll go to the airport, pick them up like their luggage.
Well, thanks for showing us around.
You're very welcome.
That's it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21ST Show. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website. 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Panlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.